Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yep.
And NPR.
All right.
Let's start with an encounter.
Yes.
Hello?
Hello?
Okay. Can you hear me okay?
I can barely hear you.
Okay, so this is our producer, Lulu Miller, was calling around trying to find some stories for this hour.
Let's see.
And she ended up on the phone with a woman named Barbara Smuts.
Is that any better?
Yeah.
Barb Smuts is now at the University of Michigan, but years ago, she was a field researcher in Tanzania working with the great Jane Goodall.
You know, following chimps at a distance and writing down everything they do and that kind of thing.
Right.
Okay.
And when she was in Tanzania, she ran into, in Gombe National Park, a particularly young male chimp named Goblin.
Will you tell me the story of Goblin?
Oh, sure.
First of all, what does he look like?
Well, he's an adolescent male.
Mm-hmm.
If he stood up, he would come up to quite a bit above my waist.
Yeah.
And almost immediately, he started picking on me in the sense that, you know, he would walk past me and just kind of jab me casually as he went by. And sometimes he would punch me with the fist. Sometimes he would just kind of whack me with an open hand or just kind of use his body to just kind of shove at me as he went past. You know, he'd look at me as he approached and I'd be going, oh, no.
And is that something they would often do with humans or was this
rare? No, no. He was in a phase of life. When a male matures, he rises in rank and before he challenges any other adult male, he rises kind of step by step through the female hierarchy.
Huh.
He basically intimidates female after female until they give in and acknowledge that he's superior, and then he'll pretty much leave them alone. So he was at the point where he dominated all but probably two of the adult females.
And you.
And me. So that's part of it, is where Goblin wasn't. The other part of it is that I'm really small.
So as you're out there doing your research, what do you think is going on? Did you think he just...
Well, I just felt like he was a bully.
Yeah.
And I was an easy target.
Yeah.
And in the evening, I would say to Jane Goodall, you know, I'd tell her what happened.
Yeah.
Ask her what to do. And she would say, just ignore him. You know, eventually he'll get bored and he'll stop doing it. Which was, you know, this kind of standard advice. This sort of myth of total scientific objectivity. Just ignore it and that it'll go away.
Yeah.
But instead he escalated. I remember one time I was sitting at the top of a hill and he came up behind me and jumped on my back, which forced me to roll down the hill. And he kind of rolled down with me. You know, we were like this ball rolling down a hill. Again, I would tell Jane and ask her what to do, and she would always say the same thing, ignore it. But one day, during the rain, it was the rainy season,
mm-hmm.
So we all carried raincoats with us. And when it wasn't raining, we would carry them on our backs so that it wasn't in the way. And Goblin walked up to me one day and yanked on my raincoat. And these raincoats, they were like our most valuable possession, you know, the raincoat. So he grabbed it, and he was going to run away with it. And so we had this tug of war. And so the two of us were standing facing each other, you know, tugging on this raincoat. And then I did something that was not premeditated at all. I just leaned forward and I punched him as hard as I could in the face.
Oh my God.
And
what did you think, like, right after you'd done it? Were you shocked at yourself that you just...
Yeah, I'd never punched anybody before, you know, much less a chimp who I was supposed to be studying from a distance. So I was shaking.
What did he do?
He just collapsed. He, like, turned into a little baby. You know, he collapsed on the ground and started whimpering. And then he looked to Figgin, who was the alpha male at the time, who was sitting nearby.
Yeah.
And he was like Figgin's little sidekick, you know, always kind of hanging out with Figgin and playing up to him. He ran over to Figgin screaming, like, this being just beat up on me. Come on, let's get her. And fortunately, Figgin did not take it seriously. I remember he just reached over with this, you know, great big hand, and without even looking at Goblin, he patted him on the head a few times and then went back to whatever he was doing. Because it could have been really bad if he had taken it seriously. Now, I did not go back and tell Jane Goodall I had punched Goblin in the nose. And I didn't tell the story for a long time.
Why not?
Well, I think, I would have gotten a lot of disapproval.
Yeah.
Anyway, Goblin never bothered me again.
So here's the reason we played that story, because here you've got this moment where you've got a scientist, Barbara Smuts, who's a trained scientist, got scientific rules of objectivity and all that, and...
She totally loses it.
Yeah, she slips. And for just that moment, she's not really a human, he's not really a chimp. The raincoat is the only important thing.
The borders have dropped is really what's happened.
Yeah. Now, we're used to thinking of borders, you know, between us and the animals, as being fixed. And most people would say this is good. Keep them there, keep us here, keep us separate.
But not in this hour. We're going to meet people who decided to go the other way. People who are trying to live intimately, and I mean really intimately,
really?
With big wild animals.
Something you could either call incredibly stupid, or our last great hope.
Because there are so many of us on the planet.
So coming up, we've got two stories of radical experiments in sharing. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab. Okay, story one. This whole show, in a way, began with a conversation with this fellow, Charles Siebert.
I am an author and a journalist. And
he wrote a book called The Washula Woods Accord, which is a great book, in which he tells... a story, which he told us in the studio as well, about a chimpanzee named Lucy. So let's just start at the beginning. Who is Lucy?
Lucy is a chimpanzee that this was found out later, born to a circus entertainer, born in their camp.
What country are we in?
In the U.S. They traveled up and down the East Coast, the May Knoll Chimp Arc Show, something like that. They were very popular in the 40s and 50s. They were wildly popular, apparently.
Oh, so this was a mom-and-pop entertainment operation that would go from town to town in the middle Atlantic states.
Exactly.
And so Lucy was born to two of the chimps that performed in this thing?
Yeah. And they used to do things like, they used to stage wrestling matches with human beings. The He-Man of the town would come in and challenge the chimp to a wrestling match.
Really? What would happen?
You know, an adult chimpanzee is about five times the strength of a human. And this guy would walk in thinking, you know, I'm going to give this chimp a run of money. And like one swipe of this chimp's forearm and the guy would be on Queer Street and be carried out. It would end so quickly.
And then the house band would go,
he's out of it.
Okay, so getting back to our story about Lucy. This is a story that begins in 1964. And it's one that Charles would have never heard about had he not bumped into this obscure old memoir.
Long out of print.
Yeah, what's the name of the book? Do you actually have it with you?
Yeah, hold on. It's called Lucy Growing Up Human, A Chimpanzee Daughter in a Psychotherapist's Family by Maurice K. Tamerlan.
Maurice K. Tamerlan, he is the psychotherapist.
He's a psychotherapist.
And he's also the dad in this story. And his wife, Jane, who's a social worker, she's the mom. Now, the thing to know was that, especially for Maurice Temmerlin, this was more than just adopting a baby chimp. This was an experiment.
Yeah.
He wanted to know, given the right upbringing, how human could Lucy become?
You know, what he says early on in this book, would she learn to love us and perhaps have other
human emotions as well? Would she be well-behaved, rebellious?
Intelligent or stupid?
What about sex?
Maurice Temmerlin actually died in 1989, but these are his words, read by radio host David Garland.
Would she mother her offspring? Could she learn to talk? How intelligent might she be?
And so how did they get her?
He says that he and his wife,
Jane, made all the arrangements.
Went and got the chimp.
On the day the infant was born.
The mother was anesthetized.
In the early morning of her second day, Jane fed the mother a Coca-Cola which had been spiked with fencyclidine, a drug which puts chimpanzees into a deep, pleasant sleep.
And the baby was taken away.
Jane named her Lucy and brought her home on a commercial airline, carried in a bassinet, her face covered with a lacy blanket. We were blissfully unaware of the complexities we were creating on the day Lucy came home.
So the baby was a day or two old?
Just 2 days old.
So it wasn't weaned?
No, and that was part of the experiment.
They bottle feed her?
Yeah.
She quickly learned to hold her own bottle. At 2 months, her eyes would focus. At 3 months, she was trying to climb out of her crib to go to people. And at 6 months, she was pretty mobile on all four limbs.
The memoir goes on. By the time she was about a year old,
she was eating at the table with us.
Forks, spoons, knives.
She would see us using silverware and immediately do so herself.
She began to dress herself in skirts.
She would often grab my hand, pull me to my feet, and beg me to chase her, always looking back to see that Daddy was not too far behind.
You know, he really went at this with this sort of full bore earnestness. You know, when he calls her his darling daughter. And
I took great pride in my daughter's achievements.
He does feel like a real parent to Lucy.
She was so responsive to being looked at, held, and stroked.
But he's also, make no mistake, treating this as a very intense, cutting-edge experiment.
The next phase of the experiment, which occupies a good deal of the book, involves one of those talents that we thought used to only be limited to us. Language.
Okay.
Can you introduce yourself, please?
Okay. My name is Roger Fouts. I'm a professor of psychology and have worked with chimpanzees since 1967.
Roger Fouts was called in by Maurice Temmerlin to address one of the, you know, crucial questions of the experiment.
Could she learn to talk?
Right.
And at the time, he was the guy. He'd just been part of a team that had proven for the first time that chimps could use sign language to communicate. So his job with Lucy was to teach her how to sign.
And I think I came into her life when she was, as I remember, it was 1970, I think it was 4 or 5. She was 4 or 5 years old.
Roger taught her signs for airplane, baby doll, ball, banana, barrette,
right.
Berry.
Yeah, yeah. So I was sort of like
blanket.
The tutor friend babysitter that would come over for a few hours.
Bow tie.
Each day and spend some time just, you know, just playing with Lucy.
Candy.
I would work on signs.
Can't.
We'd read books together and, or we'd go for walks and I would chat with her basically.
Cry. Dirty.
And he says that Lucy.
Enough.
Just sort of
picked it up.
Picked it all up.
It was like a game.
She learned some 250 signs.
Yeah.
And the big question is, okay, so is it mere mimicry or are they able to spontaneously create words and put them together in a new original way? And there's been a lot of anecdotal evidence that, in fact, Lucy did spontaneously create words.
In a later session, when shown a piece of watermelon, Lucy tasted it.
And she called it candy drink.
Huh.
And a radish had gotten quite old, and one day, you know, she was calling it food and food for, I think, several days of the study. And then she decided to eat this old radish, and she took a bite and spit it out. And I said, well, what is that? She called it cry hurt food.
Wow.
She would also lie to me.
Really?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And lying, we should also say, is another one of those things that people used to think only we do.
During one of my sessions, I came in and she had a potty accident, and that she had been potty trained, but sometimes she didn't always make it. And I was upset because I was now faced with having to clean it up. And so I said, whose is that? And she said, Sue.
Who's Sue?
Sue was one of my students that would come in and spend time with Lucy, too. I said, no, Sue's not here. And finally she
blamed it on
fessed
Sue.
Up and, yeah, said Lucy and sorry and so on.
Sue?
Yes.
This is Sue.
Sue Savvy-Drumbaugh.
The grad student of yours who says she didn't actually see that line take place.
Yes, well, I wasn't there.
But she told us that when she met Lucy, she was blown away by, well, the incongruity of it all. Like, for instance, every time she would walk in the house, Lucy would just
walk casually into the kitchen and search through the cupboard for the kind of tea she wanted that day and put some water in a kettle and put it on the stove and make us tea.
Yeah, it became a routine. I'd come in and she would start the tea.
It was the casualness with which she did it. The kind of air about it that, yes, I'm making tea and I would like you to have some too because tea is what we do. And so the thing to do was to sit down and to casually sip the tea with Lucy and casually look through the magazines, listen to the radio. And
what magazines would she look at?
Well, she looked at, I think, House and Garden and some magazines that had pictures of women and children in them, whatever the Timmerlands had out.
Wow.
Lucy had developed an awareness of our emotions. If Jane is distressed,
Timmerland's wife,
Lucy notices it immediately and attempts to comfort her by putting her arm about her, grooming her, or kissing her. If Jane is sick, Lucy would exhibit tender protectiveness toward her, bringing her food, sharing her own food.
And as we get to this next part, this is sort of the midpoint of the memoir, it's useful to sort of remember a basic fact of biology. Speciation happens when you've got one group of creatures that gets divided into two, and then these two groups evolve away from one another. And eventually they get so far away from each other that they can't have babies.
And nature makes sure that they can't have babies by making one species basically undesirable to the other. You look across, you're a baboon, you look across at a chimp and you go, eh.
Yeah, you're only sexually attracted to your own kind. That is essentially what a species is. Now, this isn't something you're supposed to be able to learn or unlearn.
This is just the way it is.
Yeah, which brings us to some troubling passages in the book. Beginning really on page 105. Can you read it?
Yeah.
And we should warn that this next minute and a half contains a sexual reference.
One afternoon around 5 o'clock, Jane and I were sitting in the living room when we observed this sequence of behavior.
Lucy left the living room and went to the kitchen, opened a cabinet and took from it a glass, opened a different cabinet and brought out a bottle of gin.
Gin?
Yeah, she loved gin and tonics.
That's actually not the important part. It's what happens next. She takes her gin, goes back to the living room, sits on the couch, and there's really no other way to say this, she starts to masturbate. But even that's not the important part. It's actually in the very next moment that a boundary that took approximately 6 million years to establish dissolves. Na, 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 na. Mr. Timmerland sees Lucy doing this, and he thinks, na, 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 na. This is a perfect experimental moment. Na, 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 so he runs off to the mall.
Buys a copy of Playgirl magazine and brings it back to her.
This is full of naked guys.
Yeah, and Lucy would masturbate to these centerfold.
I was not a part of that. I was never there when Lucy looked at the porno.
But Sue
magazine.
Says that she was there for what happened next.
Yes. I was there when she was introduced to her first adult male chimpanzee.
Had Lucy ever seen another chimpanzee before?
Never seen another chimpanzee from the moment of birth.
Wow. She says they brought this male chimp in
to see if Lucy was attracted to chimpanzee males.
And was she?
Well, the male chimpanzee would sit there with his hand held out toward her, and she was very frightened, and she tried to move away.
It was then, says Sue, that she realized that in every way that mattered, Lucy was no longer a chimp. She was stranded.
Right in between this great divide that I knew was there between humans and non-humans, and I did not know how to negotiate this. There is no category in our language except a mythical one for something that's not human and not animal.
Message 8.
Hi, this is Charles Siebert calling a little too late on Friday, I'm afraid, to read the show credits. Here goes. Radiolab is funded in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
And the National Science Foundation. Radiolab is produced by WNYC.
And distributed by NPR.
NPR. Bye-bye.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.